Case number 077067, James A. Thompson, Jr., appellant versus District of Columbia et al.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Micah Saub. I represent James Thompson. Your Honors, no matter how the lottery board gussies it up, they fired Mr. Thompson. They did so in retaliation for his protected speech, and they used the reduction in force as a convenient way to disguise their conduct and avoid having to be held accountable for it. Now, the court has addressed particular questions to counsel, and I will begin my comments with those Fifth Amendment questions without in any way suggesting that I devalue my First Amendment claim. First, when the lottery transferred Mr. Thompson to a temporary position, a position which was already slated for elimination as part of the reduction in force, he was removed from service within the meaning of that phrase under D.C. law. Now, I have not found any binding precedent that answers the question, what does it mean to be, quote, removed from service? But I think that we can begin to get our answer from this common law notion of a purposeful act. Taking some action, knowing the consequences that are likely from that action, and intending those consequences. The District of Columbia, the Lottery Board, intended the consequence which came about, which is the termination of Mr. Thompson's employment. The facts that were alleged in the complaint, specifically paragraph 61, make it clear that a jury could certainly conclude that the defendant intended those consequences. Now, the fact that the defendant makes the claim that this was a reduction in force and not a person-specific termination changes nothing. The defendant's claim is a sham. We know the facts of this case fairly well. On one day, they create a list. On the next day, they tell Mr. Thompson he's being transferred into a position on that list. In West versus Grand, in Mizek versus City of Chicago, the 10th and the 7th Circuit Courts of Appeals held that when an employee alleges that a RIF was a pretext for a person-specific termination, if there is not a bona fide RIF, then that employee is entitled to due process. And there are very important policy reasons not to permit this sort of sham to continue. In Arnett versus Kennedy, 1974, the Supreme Court held that the legislature may not constitutionally authorize the deprivation of a property interest in public employment once conferred without appropriate procedural safeguards. Now, if an employer can bypass those due process protections by claiming that the employee is removed because of a lack of funds or because of a reorganization, or because of a reduction in force, then the employer will have an easy, and I would posit, Your Honors, a frequently used method of circumventing the due process clause. We cited Hartman versus the City of Providence, a District of Rhode Island case, in our reply brief, and that court had a neat summary of this point. The court wrote, "The courts cannot permit the exception to become a convenient ruse whereby a government agency, simply by affixing a label, can avoid the necessity for demonstrating cause when it wishes to dismiss a particular employee."
Can I ask you what procedures were available under D.C. law to challenge something like this? Was what Judge Edwards referred to in the prior opinion.
Yeah, it would have been, I think, the typical pre-termination and post-termination hearings. At the very least, there would have
been. Are there DC procedures already in place for that kind of challenge? Administrative procedures?
Yes, Judge.
And why don't those satisfy whatever processes do?
If that matter had been heard by whatever process is in place in the District of Columbia, they would have addressed it as essentially a grievance to determine whether it was a violation of merit system rules and not whether it was a violation of his First Amendment rights, whether his First Amendment rights could not be vindicated.
That's true on the First Amendment side, but on the procedural due process side, I thought you only had a due process claim when the process in place by the local government or state government was inadequate, not just merely that you were terminated.
I think it would be both, Judge Kavanaugh. I think that it's a question both of the of ensuring that the process be afforded to him, and also
there aren't any allegations in the complaint at all about the process.
Well, so. And I think part of the issue in that regard, Your Honor, excuse me, is that I believe that there would have been a timeliness concern, and I can't state this with certainty. I want to be clear about that. In view of the way the termination was structured, we sort of had a Ricks problem, and this case was filed in 1997. My memory is hazy from then, but I believe there was a sort of a Ricks problem whereby they said on one day, your employment will be ending in a month. And of course, this goes directly to the Fifth Amendment claim as well. Your employment will be ending. They took away that substantive right on that day, but his employment did not actually end for several months thereafter. First, there was a delay before the RIF was implemented, and then they put him in a temporary position. And it was only when that temporary position ended that his job didn't exist, or a job didn't exist for him. And I believe then that we faced a timeliness concern. Again, that's my recollection.
There's also a D.C. whistleblower statute.
There is now. I don't know that there was in 1996 and 97. I'm sorry, Your Honor. There's one further comment. In answering the question of whether being transferred to a RIFT position constitutes removal from the service, it's worth noting that termination, like most things in law, is not a black and white thing. The best way for me to illustrate this is through the notion of a constructive discharge. An employer which substantially reduces an employee's pay or substantially reduces the level of responsibility has engaged in what we call a constructive discharge. That is, the employer has taken away an important benefit of employment such that the employee would reasonably understand his or her employment to have come to an end. Now, in this case, when the lottery transferred Mr. Thompson from his secure, permanent position, a position which he knew would not end unless he engaged in what we call for-cause conduct, and put him into a position which would indeed end in 1 month, they were taking away an important benefit from him. It was at that time, the early date, not the late date, if I can put it that way, that the employer engaged in the inappropriate conduct. Next, the court asked whether the control board's September 21st order validly placed lottery employees under the control of the CFO. To answer this, Your Honors, I want to highlight the text of the control board's enabling legislation. Section 207B of what's H.R. 1345, unfortunately, I don't have the site to the statute itself, but it's section 207B of that provision, requires the control board to make recommendations to the district. The district then can either accept or reject those recommendations. Now here, the September 21st order made a recommendation which the district was free to accept or reject. The September 21st order effectuated nothing. It had no power of law. Now if the District of Columbia rejected the proposal, the recommendation, in that case, the control board could have stepped in and said, well, we'll vote on the matter, and if we have a majority vote, what we want to happen will happen. Now, here, the CFO attempted to accept the recommendation. That is clear. The CFO attempted to accept the recommendation. But the language of the enabling legislation of the control board is very important here. The acceptance or rejection has to come from, and this is a quote, the mayor or the council, whichever has the authority to adopt the recommendation. Your Honors, the CFO did not have the authority to adopt the recommendation to move the lottery from being an independent agency to being a subordinate agency of the CFO. They simply did not have that authority. The lottery board was an independent agency in accordance with the provisions of the DC Charter. Now, we know that the DC City Council is authorized to reorganize the government. That's a DC Statute 1-204.04B. The council could have acted. The council could have accepted the recommendation and enacted it. But the chief financial officer did not have the power to reorganize the District of Columbia government. So while the CFO attempted to accept the recommendation promulgated by the control board on September 21st, that acceptance was ineffective.
If you're correct about this, did he have nevertheless the independent authority to declare them to be at-will employees?
No, Your Honor. The CF, the employees of the District of Columbia government, which enjoyed, those employees who enjoyed procedural protections, Fifth Amendment protections, who were, who could only be fired for cause, enjoyed an important constitutional safeguard. And the Supreme Court has said time after time that those safeguards can indeed be removed, but only by engaging in appropriate process, and minimally that would mean that some act of law, whether by the DC Council or by Congress, would have to make that change. And ultimately that did happen, just as ultimately in 2005 there was an act of Congress which moved the lottery board from being an independent agency to being under the CFO. And that act of Congress, by the way, I think illustrates that there did have to be some kind of lawmaking to make the change from the lottery board being an independent agency to those employees being under the CFO. The same thing is true for the issue of whether the CFO could make those employees at will. He cannot. An act by the District of Columbia government or by Congress can effectuate that, but the CFO does not have that authority.
Well, it seems that what the authority was doing here was looking at this 1996 Omnibus Act, which had done this for a lot of employees, and saying, well, we can extend that to these other employees.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what they seem to be thinking. And here's the thing. I have looked at numerous cases and numerous pleadings in which my colleagues in the District of Columbia law offices have made arguments to the various courts that OCRA applies to CFO. And they keep arguing it and arguing it and arguing it. And I keep looking at the same text. The text hasn't changed. In 2005, there was that change. OCRA does not include, and we've said this repeatedly in our brief, does not include the lottery board. And what's more, when I look at that, I don't see the chief financial officer and all of his employees. I see five particular departments listed. There is nothing that says that every employee who comes to be under the jurisdiction of the CFO is an at-will employee. Now, was that poor drafting by Congress? Perhaps it was. It may well be that they intended CFO to have the power to designate anybody who comes to work for him as an at-will employee. But that's not what the statute says. And we're not at liberty to redefine the statute when the statute is, after all, quite clear. That statute simply does not say that anybody who comes to work for the CFO, anybody who works within the aegis of the CFO, is an at-will employee. I have less than a minute, Your Honors, if there are no questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, William J. Earle on behalf of the Appellee District of Columbia. Addressing the Fifth Amendment claim, as appellant has done, I'd first point out that it is well settled that the property interests that are protected by the due process clause are created by local law, not by the Constitution. In this instance, while Mr. Thompson was indeed a member of the career service in July of 1996 when Executive Director King announced that he was being moved to a position that was slated for RIF. By the time of his ultimate departure from employment with the District of Columbia in the latter part of January of 1997, he no longer had the rights and benefits of a career service employee because he and the rest of the employees of the lottery board had been converted to at-will status under the aegis of the chief financial officer. Addressing, if I may, the what I think is the ultimate question in this regard, whether the Section 152A of the OCRA gave authority for both the Financial Responsibility and Management Assistance Authority and the Chief Financial Officer to place the employees of the lottery board under the financial the chief financial officer's authority. The language, as counsel has alluded to, is indeed clear. Section 152A is not exclusive in its listing of the five agencies that it places under the direction and control of the chief financial officer. Section A reads that the heads of all personnel of the following offices, comma, together with all other District of Columbia executive branch accounting, budget, and financial management personnel shall be appointed by and serve at the pleasure of and shall act under the direction and control of the chief financial officer. In undertaking to issue its resolution and recommendation of September 21st, 1996, the authority was acting not only under its own authority under section, it ends up being section 207C of the finally enacted Financial Responsibility and Management Assistance Act of 1995. It was also acting pursuant to section 152A in implementing that language.
Do you disagree with counsel's view that what the way the authority works is to make these recommendations which have to be accepted or rejected by the mayor or the council?
No, I don't disagree with that at all. That is the framework under 207C for the recommendation authority, which was one of the most significant authorities that the authority had during a control year.
But you think that under the OCRA, they had expanded authority?
They didn't have expanded authority, but they were undertaking to implement the directions of Congress in 152A, as was the chief financial officer.
And you think when there's a direction from Congress, then this process where they make the recommendation isn't operative?
Your Honor, I think the recommendation procedure is operative, but I don't think that it takes away the authority that the authority had under its own statute, not just 207C, which it was following. And as a practical matter, it did make a recommendation to the council, which the council did accept. Unfortunately, the mayor vetoed that legislation, which ultimately necessitated that Congress did pass the legislation that it did in 2005.
Okay, well, let me ask you about that, because if these employees, by virtue of this additional language, this expansive language,
yes, Your Honor.
If they were already covered under the OCRA,
yes,
and in fact were already at-will employees, why did we need this additional legislation?
Your Honor, I think for clarity purposes, if nothing else, what we had until such time as the 2005 legislation was enacted, and I would point out that by its language, it is retroactive to the point when the chief financial officer office was established. It tracks the language of the Financial Responsibility and Management Assistance statute itself in 1995, which established the chief financial officer's office, indicating that upon the appointment of the first chief financial officer, these entities become part of his or her office. But I think what was at play in September of 1996 was an effort for some immediacy in terms of implementing the directives of the of Section 152A of the OCRA. Once again, the authority did undertake to follow its 207C recommendation framework. It also had the power under, and I'm trying to think about it, 207D, to issue orders in the shoes of the mayor, if you will, with regards to the business of the district government. And so what was issued on September 21st, 1996, with both a resolution and order and a recommendation under 207C, while the recommendation approach ended up not achieving what the authority had hoped to achieve, I submit that it nonetheless had authority to undertake what it did at that point pursuant to its 207D authority to issue orders in the shoes of the mayor. Once again, I think the expansive language of 152A also provided authority for the CFO independently of the authority.
So when do you think this change actually occurred? Was it the date that the OCRA is passed, its effective date, the date of the order?
Your Honor, I think the authority for it was established when the OCRA became effective. It was thereafter implemented. They were, and I think once again, the resolution of the authority was one instance of implementation, followed several days later.
What I'm trying to figure out,
because
maybe it's significant here, is when did Mr. Thompson
become
an at-will employee?
I do understand that, Your Honor. I think. Without consideration of either the authority's September 21st, 1996 resolution and recommendation, or the CFO's subsequent order that Mr. Thompson became an at-will employee upon the enactment of Section 152A, of the OCRA.
So on its enactment, not its effective date. So you would say September
21. Well, it's effective date.
It's effective date.
September
30th, then.
And alternatively, Your Honor, he and his fellow employees became at-will employees retroactively as a result of the 2005 legislation of Congress that amended the Home Rule Act to explicitly include the lottery board as an original entity of the office of the chief financial officer, all employees of whom served at will. So under either one of those paths, I would submit that as of September 28th, which was the date on which the RIF articulated in the amended complaint was scheduled to take effect, and certainly by January 29th, 1997, the date that we are informed by the amended complaint that Mr. Thompson was ultimately terminated on the expiration of the temporary position that he was placed in. On either one of those dates, by either one of those dates, he was an at-will employee.
And the first of those dates was what?
The first of those dates was September 28th, Your Honor, 1996, which was the date on which the RIF was to be implemented. But as the amended complaint informs us, he was not RIF'd. He was rather transferred to a temporary position.
But wasn't he transferred to that position that was going to be RIF'd before that?
Two different positions, Your Honor. If you read the amended complaint, you're talking about two different positions. He was first of all informed in July of 1996 that he was becoming part of a new security team for the lottery board, and then the next day he was informed that that position was designated for RIF on September 28th, 1996.
Now, let me go back to the threshold question here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is, when he's transferred to that position that's scheduled to be eliminated,
yes,
is that a reduction in rank or pay or removal from the service as defined by the D.C. Code?
The position that was designated for reduction in force, mm-hmm, in July. No, Your Honor, the D.C. Court of Appeals has explicitly held that a RIF was not an adverse action within the meaning of 1-617 0.1B, which was the operative provision of the Comprehensive Merit Personnel Act at that time with regards to career service employees' rights against adverse actions. The Comprehensive Merit Personnel Act did indeed have procedures that were to be followed with regards to RIFs. And we alluded to those procedures indeed in our brief in the earlier appeal.
How could it be a due process violation if procedures were available?
They were very adequate procedures, Your Honor.
You haven't really argued that.
I'm sorry?
You haven't really argued
that. No, I have not argued that.
It's
because in the end, Mr. Thompson has had no due process rights because of his at-will status. In the earlier appeal, I did attempt to explain to the court that if he had a due process right, those procedures provided him a very limited window for complaint with regards to the proposed RIF, and therefore his due process rights had not been violated by the fact that he did not have a pre-deprivation opportunity to complain with regards to that RIF circumstance. With regards to the second position, the transfer to the temporary position that was slated for and did ultimately expire. I have not found any authority that explicitly places that sort of employment decision under the heading of an adverse action, but the municipal regulations with regards to personnel do explicitly say that an employee must be given the opportunity to waive any rights or benefits that they might lose from a proposed transfer. So if he were, so if Mr. Thompson were a career service employee on the date of the transfer or the expiration, the government was obliged to at least give him the opportunity to explicitly waive his rights as a career service employee. But once again, we submit that he was not a career service employee and therefore had no entitlement to due process. If there are no other questions, I'll submit. Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Kavanaugh, the remedy that might have been available under the District of Columbia law would not have been sufficient. It would not have been appropriate. The District of Columbia denominated its actions as a reduction in force, and by doing so, deprived Mr. Thompson of any meaningful, or for that matter, I believe, of any post- termination remedies under D.C. law.
It hasn't been argued in any event, so.
It hasn't been argued. So, this court has the power to see through this sham and to recognize what has happened and when it happened. Mr. Thompson was denied his substantive right to ongoing, continued, permanent employment without risk of termination absent engaging in for-cause conduct. That happened on August 22nd. By the way, my colleague has mentioned July, but the record indicates that it was, in fact, August 22nd and August 23rd. On August 22nd, they created the list of positions to be terminated. On August 23rd, they said, Mr. Thompson, we're transferring you into this doomed position. The Seventh Circuit and the Tenth Circuit have already held that when the RIF is mere pretext, we see right through it, because otherwise, due process goes away. You lose the due process rights. The bad act occurred, the deprivation of rights occurred on August 23rd, 1996. Even if there was a conversion to at-will status prior to 2005, which we acknowledge, it was long after the bad act occurred, long after the deprivation of rights occurred. And by the way, this change in law in 2005 that retroactively placed the lottery board under the CFO is obviously irrelevant, because one cannot retroactively deprive government employees of due process rights. So while it was retroactive just as a matter of structure, it cannot be retroactive for purposes of denying due process rights. I thank the court for the court's attention and interest here in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Saab. Mr. Earl, thank you. Case is submitted.